When I was 6 years old, I wanted to be one of the three kings in the school nativity play. In particular, the one that got to wear the gold cloak. Actually, it was an old curtain, and I thought it suitably regal and impressive. Unfortunately, my teacher then made the controversial decision that roles in the play should be given out on the basis of acting ability. And as a result, I was allocated the role of the rear end of donkey number two. Fortunately, it was not a speaking part. It then transpired that there was actually only one donkey in the nativity story. Nowhere does it say that as Mary set out for Bethlehem, she took a spare donkey in case the first one broke down, or that donkey number one had a friend who was at a loose end that day and came along for the ride. I was devastated. Not a kingly part, not even a bit part. I was a no part, or to be more accurate, the rear end of a no part. However, the following year, things looked up. I hit the big time. I was chosen to be King Herod, a role which involved a lot of stomping around and looking grumpy. A part I played to perfection, and some would say have done ever since. I love nativity plays. They are wonderful, particularly when things go wrong. But the problem is they're not very accurate. They miss bits out and they add other bits in. They don't relate very accurately to what actually happened at the first Christmas. For example, the Magi, about whom we think during this season of Epiphany. We three kings of Orient are. Well, we don't know that there were three, as Penny pointed out to us last week. They almost certainly weren't kings, because Magi were learned and wise astrologers or professors, and they probably didn't come from the Orient. It just says they came from the East. But one does have a certain sympathy with the hymn writer. We indeterminate number of learned ones from somewhere a fair way east of Judea lacks a certain poetic something, doesn't it? It doesn't stand either. So we make bits up, we tend to embellish the story. We miss other bits out as well. For example, the bit that was referred to in our second reading. That is a reading that rarely gets read. It's about a scene that never gets featured in any nativity production that certainly I've ever seen, because the massacre of the innocents does not play too well with many parents. Neither does it add to the festive spirit. So it missed out. But the fact is, it happened. The true Christmas story does not end with the Magi bowing and a small boy receiving gifts. It ends with a king murdering and small boys dying. Because the Bible story is set in the real world, the world that you and I live in, where these things happen. It tells us about the ups and downs of real life, the ups and downs of our lives, our joys and our sadnesses, our triumphs, and our tragedies too. And the Bible gets it all. It covers it all. It is not an escape from reality. It is about reality. It's about the cries of a newborn baby and the cries of grieving mothers. The real world into which the real God came. Epiphany means revelation. If you look at the reading, you find out what is revealed, or rather, who is revealed. Verse 2. Magi come from the east to Jerusalem. They say, where is the one who's been born king of the Jews? Herod is disturbed. And he calls together, therefore, all the chief priests and teachers of the law. He asks them where the Messiah was to be born, in Bethlehem in Judea. For this is what the prophet has written. You, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least, for out of you will come a ruler who will shepherd my people Israel. That's what's revealed. It is long-awaited shepherd king whom the prophets have spoken about. He is the one who will rule. He will bring his plans to fruition. There will be no frustration, no hold-ups, no delays, no problems. He will work out these plans perfectly. He will provide the experience of fulfillment and safety and justice and joy that we all long for. He will bring peace with God and each other. In his kingdom, there will be no empty places at the Christmas dinner table and no pawn shops in January. this tiny baby will be the ruler of an eternal country whose immigration policy is to welcome anyone who will swear allegiance to this king. No matter their background or their past, this country where the only exclusions will be suffering and sin and fear and frustration and death. And the Epiphany reveals to us the reality of this kingdom and the response that is required to this coming king. No one back there who heard the news that Jesus had born had any option at all. They had to respond. The king heard the news, some religious experts heard the news, the Magi heard the news, and they all respond. And they respond very differently. And there are three different responses define for us the options of our response. They set out the options available to us as we respond to the Shepherd King who has revealed to us this Epiphany right now at the beginning of this new year, 2019. Let's look at them briefly together. First of all, we have the king, King Herod. How could this happen, this massacre, this appalling, gruesome, horrifying event? Well, it happened because of a turf war. Turf wars are fought in the estates of South London amongst gangs and in the corridors of Westminster amongst politicians. They happen on the shop floor and in boardrooms and in synods too. They're a battle for control. People are willing to do damage in order to establish that they, rather than somebody else, is in control. And so it was with Herod. Verse 1 we read, after Jesus was born in Bethlehem in Judea, during the time of King Herod. This was the time of King Herod. It had taken a lot of blood, mainly other people's, and sweat and steam for him to climb the greasy pole. But he had got there. He had arrived, he's in charge, he'd made it, and Judea belongs to him. But now, he hears the disturbing news that the Christ has been born. The true ruler of Israel has come. So Herod has a decision to make, doesn't he? What is he going to do? Will he submit to this new king and rule Judea under him, under his authority? Or will he resist and seek to destroy his new beloved lot? Tragically, but altogether predictably, he takes the latter course and he tries to get rid of Jesus, and Bethlehem toddlers were massacred as a result. He was prepared to kill any number of boys just to be sure that he'd taken out this one. Because he would not have Jesus rule over him or his territory. Now, Herod had a lot of turf, if you think about it, didn't he? I don't have very much, but I do have my own life, and you have your life too. And the fundamental question that all of us have to address at the beginning of 2019 is who's in charge of it? Who will rule for you and for me in the coming year? Who rules? The hard truth is that, naturally speaking, we are all of us mini Herods, and we damage other people as a result. Not by committing mass murder, but by acting in less noticeable ways, thoughtlessly, selfishly, we diminish other people. The person whose heart we selfishly broke, who can't quite put it behind them. The person we laughed at, shattering their confidence. The person we trod on to get promotion, who's now twisted by bitterness. The person we never even noticed and therefore ignored, who feels lonely and worthless. When we say no to Jesus, this is my turf, not yours, that is what life begins to look like. And it is ugly. It's what the Bible calls sin, this refusal to accept Jesus as king, this desire to get rid of him. It's what the Bible calls sin, and it's ugly, and it is futile as well. Have a look at verse 19 over the page. Key words are three words at the beginning of verse 19. After Herod died, an angel of the Lord appeared in a dream to Joseph. Tells him to get up and go back to Israel. That's what he does in verse 21, and then we read in verse 23, that Joseph went and lived in a town called Nazareth, so was fulfilled what was said through the prophets, that Jesus would be a Nazarene. Herod had an awful lot going for him. He had priests to advise him, he had wise men to inform him, he had soldiers to kill for him. But he could nevertheless not do what he wanted to do. He couldn't accomplish his plan. He wasn't able to do it. Because God was in control and he wasn't. Through this whole passage, this whole story, with all its ups and downs, we see God at work, in control, moving people around here and there, protecting the Messiah, placing him exactly where he wants him to be, in accordance with his word. By the time Joseph brought his family back to Nazareth, only one of the two kings is still alive, and it's not Herod. The turf he killed to keep was taken away, and so it is with all who choose to resist Jesus, and to live like that. Queen Victoria, who ruled over a larger stretch of territory than first century Judea, said that she couldn't wait to meet Jesus when she died. She was looking forward to it. And she was asked why this was, and she said, "So that I may cast my crown before him." Great lady, isn't she? Herod wasn't prepared to cast his crown before Jesus, so in the end he lost it, and that's the king who resists. Then second, this is a bit more subtle, the priests. They're referred to in verse 3 and 4. When Herod called together all the people's chief priests and teachers of the law, he asked them where the Messiah was to be born. "In Bethlehem of Judea," they replied. "Well, this is what the prophet has written." The chief priests and the teachers of the law were experts, and they were religious. They know every detail of every promise that God has ever made. And the answer they give is spot on, isn't it? It's absolutely right. The Christ will be born in Bethlehem. But here's the thing. They never go to Bethlehem. The answer's right, but the response is wrong. They hear a claim about the coming king, and they do nothing. It was a journey of 4.4 miles, and they didn't make it. No doubt they went back to the temple and admired the architecture and the ambience. They enjoyed the ritual and the tradition, but they didn't see Jesus. They were so busy doing good works and establishing their moral credentials that they don't have time to go see a small child in a small town in the back end of nowhere. So they don't find Jesus. They don't know Jesus for all their religiosity. They miss the point of everything that the temple stands for. In our world today, I think there are a lot of Herods about, angrily and aggressively resisting Jesus, and they write books. Most of what they write is rubbish. And they mock Christians, the secular establishment and intelligentsia. But you know, I think there are more priests around. Politely but insistently ignoring Jesus, happy to be busily religious and good, adopting the message of Invictus. Do you know that poem? The famous poem by William Ernest Henley. "I am the master of my faith. I am the captain of my soul." The religious version of that is, "I am the master of my faith. I am the captain of my own salvation." And so you see, we try to be our own saviours. But that's a deception. We think we can cover the dirt with a layer of goodness, but we can't. Only God can reach down and cleanse us. For he is in control of salvation too. Think about it. God the Father was in control at Jesus' birth, wasn't he? So Herod's attempt to kill Jesus failed. And God the Father is still in control at Jesus' death. So the religious leader's attempt to kill him succeeded. God is in control of salvation. And we can be saved only by that birth and that life and that death. So that's another question to ponder. Who saves? Who saves? Who will save for you and for me? I pray that it will be Jesus. lest we join that company who, like the priests, sail on into eternity, hold beneath the waterline, and not even know it. The king resists, the priests ignore, then finally the magi worship. Verses 9 to 11, I don't need to read those verses, you know them well. How they come and bow down and worship and present these gifts. I wonder whether you know who came to visit you when you were born. I wonder whether you know that. I do know because my mother told me on more than one occasion. It was my father. It was his friend Brian. It was a nurse who'd been present at the birth, and a lady called Linda, who nobody knew, but she was in the same hospital and she was having a baby, and that was it. So far as I know, the Queen was not informed that one R.J. Rendell had entered the world. The professors of Oxford, Cambridge, Harvard and Yale universities did not pack their bags in order to peer over the side of my cot. And President Dwight D. Eisenhower did not knock on the door and ask if he could give me some presents. He was the president in 1954, just in case you were wondering. I mean, all of that would be crazy, wouldn't it? But this is not crazy. My birth was of no significance except for a few people. This birth is of total significance to everyone, everywhere, for all time. And therefore these powerful men, these wealthy men, these important men, the Magi, drop everything and come to me. That is the right response, the response of worship. They travelled hundreds of miles for months and months with very expensive gifts to the far corner of an empire. We have come to worship him, they said, and that's what they did. And that is what we need to do too, don't we? Who rules? Who saves? Who satisfies? In other words, who or what will we worship? Where will we seek our joy and our fulfillment and our meaning in the coming year? Worship means giving up our time to Jesus. It means asking for more knowledge about him, as they did. It means putting ourselves out for him, giving our best to him. It means allowing Jesus to be at the centre of our lives, shaping our decisions, our diaries, our minds, and the use of our wallets. And these are the options. And they are the only options. There are none others. Resist, ignore, or worship. All the way of Herod, the priests, or the Magi. If it's an encouragement to you, there was another professor. He didn't come from the East, he came from Oxford. You've heard of him, C.S. Lewis. He wrote The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe and many other books too, and he became a Christian in his 30s, describing himself as the most dejected and reluctant convert in all England. He fought hard against Jesus, but in the end he gave in to the beauty and the truth of the one who lies at the centre. And there at the centre of the first Christmas, he hung on the cross, the first Easter, and he is revealed to us, to you and to me, now, here, in this season and in this new year. C.S. Lewis said he worshipped him who I had most earnestly desired not to meet. I wonder whether you know the title of the book that he wrote as a result of that experience. The book called Surprised by Joy. He experienced joy, just like they did the Magi. Overjoyed, heart swelling, heart stopping, mind-boggling joy. So as we set off into a new year together, let us not resist. It's ugly and it's futile. Or ignore, because we need his cleansing and forgiveness. Rather, let us worship him with all our heart, all our mind, all our strength, all our soul. And if we do, we too will be surprised by joy. Now and forever. Amen.